You're listening to the Samuel Andreyev podcast. Today, I decided it would be interesting to talk with a poet about music, and not just any poet. My guest today is Kenneth Goldsmith. Kenneth Goldsmith is an American poet. His writing has been called some of the most exhaustive and beautiful collage work yet produced in poetry by Publishers Weekly. He is the founding editor of Ubuweb and is a senior editor of Penn Sound at the University of Pennsylvania, where he teaches. He hosted a weekly radio show at WFMU from 1995 to June 2010. He's published many books of poetry, notably Fidget, Soliloquy, Day, and his American trilogy. He is the editor of I'll Be Your Mirror, the selected Andy Warhol interviews, which is the basis for an opera, Trans Warhol, that premiered in Geneva in 2007. He's published three books of essays, including Against Expression, Uncreative Writing, Wasting Time on the Internet, and most recently, Duchamp is My Lawyer. In 2013, he was appointed the first poet laureate of the Museum of Modern Art. I don't know too many poets who have done as much for music as you have, and I'd like to start there. In fact, you've spent a great deal of your career focused on promoting the work of other people. So through Ubuweb, through your radio show, and also through your teaching, I'm just interested in where that impulse comes from, because you don't have to do these things. You know, you could spend 100% of your time on your own creative projects.
Yeah, but no poet can spend 100% of their time writing poetry. It's impossible. I remember once reading a New Yorker profile of John Ashbery, and half the profile was spent talking about the time that John wastes between writing poems, because John, unlike myself, didn't do anything other than his own creative work. So they would have these moments in the profile where Ashbery gets up and kind of looks at his hair and says, oh, gee, I need a haircut today. Maybe this hair is a little bit too long. And, you know, he'd look at his face a little bit and kind of shuffle around, make a cup of coffee, you know, and then have to go back to writing, which is sort of, you know, the classic fear of the blank page. Of course, as a conceptual writer, I never had any fear of the blank page, because it was just about churning enough stuff, you know, just pushing a button and basically feeding supply text into a machine and it coming out the other end. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't really, I mean, it does take time, but I also find that like painters spend a lot of time painting because often have something to sell, so it becomes a business, you know, or successful artists. Poets have nothing to sell, you know, so you just, there's no way that you can do that. So what do you do with the rest of your time, particularly if you have, you know, a lot of knowledge at your hands? I mean, why not share it?
So, but that took the form of posting things on the internet at a very, very early stage. How did that happen? How did you start Ubuweb?
I was a visual artist. And I speak from experience, because I actually had a pretty good career in the 80s in New York as a visual artist, but it quickly turned into a business, right? And I had to employ people. And at a certain point, I was spending more time being a business person than I was being an artist. This is what happens to successful artists in New York. Be careful what you wish for. And I thought, gee, I'm finding myself doing something I don't want to do, and that's being a businessman. I went to be an artist so I wouldn't have to be a businessman. Mm-hmm. And here I am being a businessman in art. I said, this is really not what I want to do. And at the same time, the work was sculptural and it was drifting toward language. I was making these big books and carving words into them. They were really beautiful, out of wood. And I got more interested in the language on the books than actually making the books. The books took a really long time to make, and there was always a nice paycheck at the end because people wanted them. And I found myself like, but wait a minute, I'm more interested in the words. And so I began to then shed the sculpture, and I became a text artist, right? A text-based artist. And I said, okay, well, if I can work with the words quicker if I just make text art. But text art is a really bad idea, because people want to go into galleries and they want to like a quick hit. You want to see something. They say spend about 3 seconds in front of an artwork on the average. And I was putting heaps of language into the gallery, to the point where people would walk into the gallery and they would walk right out of the gallery because they're like, I'm not reading this. So it was a square peg, you know, in a round hole, really. And at that point, I said, well, gee, maybe I should just become a writer. And I then decided to stop being a text artist. And I'm sitting there with a laptop, and suddenly there's no income anymore. And I'm doing beautiful kind of writings and stuff. And I thought, shit, I need a job. And so I learned HTML, because that was, the internet was just happening at that time. It's like, okay, I guess I'll become a computer programmer to support my poetry habit now that I'm no longer a financially successful artist. And it was through that, early on, I think I got into that in 93 or 94 as a job. And I began doing that kind of commercial applications to that. To me, it was just really natural to want to get visual poetry onto the internet. Because at the time, I was also kind of doing concrete poetry and visual poetry sculptures and doing text art. And then I kind of like got really into concrete poetry, which at that point, everybody had forgotten about. It was just all these dusty books. And so I started collecting these great books of concrete poetry. And when the visual web came in 1995, I began scanning them. And I was like, oh, maybe I can put these images up on the web. And when I put these old images of concrete poetry on the web, which were on these yellowed pages, they looked so beautiful when they were illuminated by the back screen. And I said, oh, this is the medium that poetry, visual poetry, has been waiting for. And I made a little, I put up a bunch of JPEGs of historical concrete poems, and I had a little site of concrete poetry. So I sent an email out to a few friends. I said, look at my little collection of digital concrete poetry. And they liked it, so I put more up. And it grew and grew and grew until it became UberWeb. And its initial idea was UberWeb was just a site for visual and concrete poetry. Then when sound came in, and do you remember Real Audio?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Real Audio, well, that was a mistake. But anyway, I got into Real Audio streaming. I start putting up sound poetry, right? Okay. So concrete poetry, and I have sound poetry. But then I encountered like a work by John Cage, like one of his big orchestral pieces with him reading, right? So he's reading a misostic and the orchestra is playing some, you know, Cagean aleatory thing. And I thought, well, this really isn't sound poetry. But it sort of is, because Cage's readings were really sound poetry, but it's not, doesn't kind of fit into the classic sound poetry thing. I said, well, what is this then? And I just thought, well, gee, it's got to be avant-garde. And at that point, it opened up UberWeb to be a space for all things that I consider to be avant-garde. And that kind of then took its own direction, because once you call something avant-garde, then almost anything can go into it. Mm. So that was really the birth of UberWeb, and all that happens between 96 and 98, and it grows from there.
Did you encounter any resistance to that idea at first? Were there poets who felt that poetry doesn't belong on the internet, or that they didn't want their work on the internet, or it belongs in a physical medium? In
other ways? There were. I mean, there were. You know, at first people were really offended. How dare you? But you have to understand, you know, it's all based. I mean, you know, it's pataphysical, because, you know, there's no money in what I do anyway, and you're not really taking anything away from people. You know, avant-garde work you mostly couldn't give away if you wanted to. So in a sense, it, you know, people at first were really offended. And I fought tooth and nail for a lot of people. And I said, look, I'm not taking any money out of your pocket. And in fact, I'm probably going to be putting money into your pocket, because your work is going to be visible. And as UberWeb grew, that became truer and truer. In a sense, for a certain type of work, if you weren't on UberWeb, you didn't exist. I didn't mean it that way, but it just sort of happened because it was the only site of its kind.
Yeah, and it's since expanded to include music and films and all sorts of things beyond concrete poetry, which is how it started. So,
well, I mean, what's avant-garde? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, the term is really problematic. You know, saddled with militaristic and patriarchal and colonial ideas. I mean, you know, it's like nobody could use the word. You know, using the word avant-garde, particularly when I was coming up in the '80s, was like, bad old white male stuff. But I thought there's some potential in this term, you know. And I remember I was really inspired in the 80s by ACT UP, who took a degenerate symbol of the pink triangle that the Nazis had put on gay people and turned it upside down into a symbol of empowerment. And I thought, well, gee, maybe I can kind of rethink the avant-garde to turn it into something that is less saddled. Mm. And my actual strategy for that was one of impurity. And, you know, the avant-garde was so pure. And I thought, well, how can I kind of pollute it with all sorts of impure ideas, thereby kind of making it, I almost want to use the word, I want to say queer, to queer it a little bit in a way that it hadn't been. And Uberweb, you know, started, I mean, my God, Uberweb really started as dead white males and a lot of it. And, you know, I've had to do a lot of searching and depurifying that history in order to make it more inclusive, which has been really fun, really interesting. I mean, there's always more work that can be done along those lines, but somehow it always seems to fit in. So that includes outsider art. I mean, come on, outsider art was never part of the avant-garde. But later, I thought of somebody like the transition of a figure like somebody like Jack Smith, who really in his day, you know, okay, Jonas Mekas and the little avant-garde cinema crowd really liked Jack Smith, but basically the art world thought he was a fairy. You know, he was a frivolous guy with glitter doing decadent gay movies, right? But then again, when I come up in the 80s, Jack Smith is having this incredible revival as being a visionary of queer cinema, and somebody who, you know, ends up being really important for reasons that were invisible in the time in which he was working. And I thought, well, that's a great transition. Maybe I, you know, there's more figures like that that I could kind of cast in that revisionist light. And that was the project of, that became really one of the projects of Uberweb, was to sort of pollute the avant-garde in that same way.
Oh, that's beautiful. And that, you know what that makes me think of, actually? It's relevant to where we are currently. We're recording this in Metz, in France, at the Centre Pompidou. And so I've been in France for approximately 20 years. And one of the things that struck me here is that a lot of the avant-garde movements that started here in the post-war era were really renegade movements. They were dangerous. There were real personal stakes, political stakes also, involved in making some of these things. An example of that would be someone like the composer Pierre Boulez, who in the 40s was absolutely on fire. He was destroying everything and trying to recast an entirely new image of what music could be. And that was a dangerous thing to do at the time, and he had very few supporters. Over time, over the decades, that became institutionalized. He gradually accumulated support from the state, from influential people, from whatever. The institutions started to accrete around what he was doing. And by the time the 70s and 80s had gotten in, the notion of avant-garde music, at least in this country, was actually quite narrow and institutionalized. So there's a kind of a strange paradox between the very quite dangerous and risky stances that had originated it versus what it had turned into. And so does that relate at all to what you're saying with respect to Uberweb? There's this trying to get away from that. There's a kind of ideological purity about what constituted avant-garde music.
Yeah, I mean, again, like in the sort of by the 80s or the 70s, 12-tone music had become like the academic style. There was nothing interesting or risky. The dullest people could get money or positions by creating really dull 12-tone work, right? And didn't, you know, and there's very, very little of that on Uberweb, you know. Instead, I mean, for Boulez, there's a gorgeous audio file that somebody gave me, and people always throw things at me, of Leonard Bernstein explaining avant-garde music to, you know, to the New York crowd. And he uses Boulez. He couches the Boulez piece between two more conventional pieces of music. He says, and now we're gonna do something really new and really experimental. And I think it's probably from the early 60s or something like that when he's trying to expose them. And he's so beautiful. He patiently walks the audience through this. And you're not going to really like this. I mean, it's extraordinarily generous. Mm-hmm. You're not going to like this. You're not really going to understand this, but I'm going to ask you to kind of open up to this. And it's, you know, and it was really beautiful. And then he rewards them, you know, with a Bach or something like that afterwards. I mean, he was really great in that way. And I thought that was such an interesting artifact. I mean, I could put up, I think we probably have like Réponse or something like that from Boulez, some of the more experimental electronic stuff. Mm-hmm. Why do I need to have that on Ubu though? I mean, it's available everywhere. I mean, UbuWeb, you know, most of the stuff on UbuWeb Sound isn't on the streaming services. There's not a lot of Henri Chopin on iTunes, you know. So the idea is if it's available elsewhere, why would it really be available on UbuWeb? Then it renders it sort of obsolete. That said, there's a big slant of electroacoustic and electronic music on UbuWeb, which I feel always like the word electronic somehow shakes it out of the dusty academic category of 12-tone dry music. Something about electronics gets everybody really excited and says, oh, this is going to be great. And now, of course, all those sounds are very nostalgic. We had this guy, this is a crazy thing. There was this 52 CD set of the, called The History of Electronic Music floating around on the internet as a torrent a million years ago. And I thought, wow, 52 CDs of electronic music, that's cool. So I downloaded it all and then put it back up on UbuWeb. It's all on one page. So it's probably 100 hours. And it starts with like a Messiaen for Onmartino, how do you say it?
Yeah, Onmartino.
Yeah. It begins with Messiaen and goes, you know, it goes through all the classical electronic music people, through Stockhausen and Boulez and Berio and Parmigiani and all of these people. And it's really a comprehensive thing. But again, the problem with that was its purity. Right? I mean, there were no women, there were no non-Western composers, you know, it was pretty much a bunch of dudes making electronic music. Again, I put it up and it was a backbone of Ubu. There's this nostalgia factor for electronic music. That those sounds are not being made anymore. And I can put almost anything up on UbuWeb and it'll be loved because of the obsolete analog warmth of the sound. I feel that like composers went really astray in the 80s with bad MIDI technology. Mm. And none of that's on Ubu. I mean, I think that's really everybody lost their way with that shit. So I kind of stop with that. So Ubu kind of, you know, in terms of electronic music sort of ends before the MIDI era, like in the 70s, like synthesizers and analog things. But that's sort of about it for me.
Well, yeah, what you're describing is quite a different vision of what the avant-garde can be, which I think is enormously stimulating. How has that changed over the two or three decades that UbuWeb has been in existence? I mean, what is the avant-garde now?
Well, what happened was in the era of the CDs, in the 90s, everybody was scraping everything they could find and reissuing things as CDs. So there used to be a place in New York on Broadway called the New Music Distribution Center, and it was this big loft on Broadway, and they had everything, because if you were an avant-garde composer or experimental or a minimalist, or you would press your own records and you would bring them over to New Music Distribution Service and they would distribute them. Their catalog was really thick with lots of really obscure things. And a joke went around in those days that everything in the New Music Distribution Center, all the covers were black and white because none of the composers could afford to make a color thing. So if you think about the Chatham Square records, right, those Philip Glass label, look at in your mind, they're all black and white images of like kind of minimalist drawings and stuff like that. It looks like everybody was broke. What happens in the 90s with the CD is that you have all sorts of people like Alga Morgan reissuing all of these things from the New Music Distribution Service, which is so incredible. I remember going to Other Music in New York at that time, a great little music store on West 4th Street. And they would have the entire history of the avant-garde repackaged, really sexy. There was like collaborations between like DJ Spooky and Xenakis. I remember that. So they were bringing in younger kind of hip people to go with these older composers. And there was like a flourishing of avant-garde. But what happened was the minute those things appeared, they began to appear on file sharing. Mm. And they began floating around file sharing. And at a certain point, and still, I began to pick that stuff up on LimeWire and those early file sharing things, and I began reposting them on UberWeb. The problem was with the CD was $25, and you know nobody could really afford that. I mean, this is why people began file sharing. I mean, if CDs had been priced like LPs, I don't think we would have had the issue of file sharing, but because they were so expensive, people were like, fuck you, throw a CD in, rip it, and share it with my friends. Mm-hmm. You asked me in the beginning, why share it? Because I came up on the internet in the 90s of like, fuck the man, fuck these CDs, I'm gonna crack them. FMU, I used to sit there during my radio show, and I used to bring my laptop, and I used to get a stack of CDs from the new bin. The best stuff, because everything came into WFMU. And I just keep feeding them and ripping them during my show. And then they'd go on to UberWeb. And at the same time, they'd go on to file sharing onto the web to enrich both free ecosystems, because I was getting them free from FMU. And I just wanted to share this stuff because it was really good, but it was really expensive and I couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was interested in enriching what at that time wasn't really yet a rich ecosystem of file sharing. Mm-hmm. So Ubu, and the funny thing about Ubu is that a lot of times, like, things will appear on YouTube that I know came from Ubu. So people download an MP4 from Ubu and then throw it up onto YouTube. Sometimes people say, but oh, no, why do you even have UberWeb anymore? Because all this shit is on YouTube. Well, I think a lot of it came from UberWeb and fed YouTube. So yet it's very, very complex. And it's really, you know, happens at a very specific moment in time. There's no way anybody would bother doing all this stuff today. Mm-hmm. But it's just this confluence of my personal history with technology changing really fast and coming up in a sharing economy that made me want to, like, you know, contribute. But I don't know, because when you love something, it's no fun to just have it for yourself. You want to, like, you know, it's kind of when you're a kid and you know, there's some band and there's some punk rock single. And you're like, man, you got to hear this, because it only gets good when somebody else gets excited by it.
Yeah.
That's the buzz.
Well, not only that, but it won't survive if people don't do that.
Listen, piracy is preservation. Mm. Because if left to market forces, and this is what happens to all the stuff that I ripped from FMU and from other music and all these tiny labels that were putting the stuff out of avant-garde music, they didn't sell anything. And they went out of business. The things went out of print almost the minute they went into print. I hope they got their money back, because they went out of print. And so at that point, we preserve them on UberWeb because, you know, you can't even find those CDs anymore. And so, you know, people get upset about piracy, but for a certain set of artifacts, they might really vanish again if they weren't bootlegged, because you bootleg something out of love. And that's why any artist, I mean, if you're an artist and you're upset that you're getting bootlegged, I mean, being bootlegged means you've made it. I mean, somebody likes your work enough to bootleg it, that means you've made it somehow. And that's an honor. You should be happy to have fans.
Absolutely. Well, and you've described this also as a form of folk archiving. You describe it in the book as it's like the difference between a flea market and then the way that that the big platforms today are operating, you know, with algorithms that increasingly determine what people will see, where it's a kind of feedback loop where, based on your previous search histories, you just get more of the same constantly. And UberWeb, you know, is much more chaotic. It's much more non-hierarchical also in the way that it's organized.
Well, I just thought, you know, sometimes people say to me, why don't you put UberWeb into one big BitTorrent, right? Or put everything on UberWeb into torrents. But torrents reward the popular, and then the stuff that, like, one person likes dies. They go, you know, they have no seeders. And I thought, well, but this is a site for unpopular culture. Like, I want the things that nobody's going to listen to be available. So instead of the BitTorrent model, we use the model of the public library, right? Where books sit on shelves for decades before anybody takes them out. But it's so important that they're sitting there. When you want that book is there. Mm-hmm. And it's there for free, by the way. Mm-hmm. You don't have to pay for that book. You can go to the library, check it out. Mm-hmm. You know? So that's the model. You know, it's a model of abundance and also promoting that which is super important, but might not really have popular traction. Mm-hmm. And that one thing, that one artifact can change lives. Mm-hmm. Just that one thing.
Oh,
it's happened to me. It's happened to all of us.
Absolutely.
So, and it's all invisible. I don't know any of this stuff. There's no feedback loop on UberWeb. I don't really know who's looking at it. There's no contact form. Nobody's home at UberWeb. you know, I used to have a contact form, but then, you know, I thought, why do I even need this? I just want it to be an open source for people to take things. Often Uber is used in ways that artists didn't intend. For example, dance DJs use it as a source for strange sounds, so that you have Bruce Nauman screaming, "Get out of my life," put to beats on dance floors in São Paulo, right? I love that. Again, that's the impure thing. There's no prescription on how to use it. And I like when it's used in a way that it wasn't intended, you know? So there's, you know, there's that.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about WFMU and unpopular music, because there's a parallel there between uncreative writing and unpopular music.
Aww.
I love this.
I love that place. I mean, it's my spiritual home. You know, I haven't done a show. I stopped doing radio in 2010, as you said. Been a really long time, but everything I ever learned, I learned at FMU. It's the most weird group of people, the most generous bunch of freaks in the world. I mean, it really is a wonderful community. And Ken Friedman, who is been the station manager of FMU for decades, really informed a lot of my thinking about legal issues, and how to get around them, about copyright, about generosity, about eclecticism. You know, so UberWeb is eclectic in the way that WFMU is freeform. Now that was a challenge, freeform radio. Like, how do you make a country music thing go into a 12-tone piece and make them speak together? It was really hard to do. And that was the mission of the station, was not to be specific. And I thought, well, that's exactly kind of the idea that UberWeb would take. I did a show called Unpopular Music because I could. I mean, it got so extreme that I would do things. There was a great piece by Thomas, by Leif Elgren and Thomas Lillenberg, that was called ZZZZZ. This is a sound piece. Those are they're like Swedish sound artists from around Fylkingen, around that group, but I think splintered off somewhere. And basically, it's these guys going like this. And then two together. And so one guy would do it, and then the other guy would respond. And they and it went for the length of a CD. It was like an hour and a half. And it's like, I had a slot from noon to three. And, you know, like when everybody wants to be energized and working. And I would just fucking play that thing. I did 3 hours of that once, you know? And the listeners hated me. And they also loved me, you know, they got it. My on-air name was Kenny G, and, you know, of course, you know, the worst musician in the world. And at first people were horrified. We have a DJ called Kenny G, but soon I became their Kenny G. But I used to receive fan mail in the early days of the internet. I had a mail to form on my WFMU page, said Kenny G's homepage. So a lot, and because it'd gotten there really early in the Alta Vista days, it had really drifted up to the top of their search thing. So if you search for Kenny G, you get the Kenny G homepage. And I used to receive fan mail for the other Kenny G, lots and lots of it. And they were the funniest things in the world. So I often did a little feature on the radio where I would put on some Kenny G Christmas music, you know, sax music, and I would read the fan letters as if they were written to me, which was really, really funny. So FMU was just, you know, FMU was so formative in so many ways to what Ubaweb was, to what my writing was. It was really, really inseparable. It really is a magical place, still is. It's become less so because, you know, now there are more places on internet radio with people doing that kind of work. And those back in the 90s when I started, there were only a few stations around America that were doing really serious freeform radio. A couple of, you know, they were kind of sister stations to WFMU. But FMU has been there, you know, for about 50 years now, I think more, been doing the same thing. It really is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
What was your first exposure to unusual music? I mean, how did you get into that?
Well, I would think that when I heard Thelonious Monk in high school, and I said, this guy's hitting the wrong keys. This is great. Wait, you can't do that, but it sounded so good. I thought, this is very strange. And also, you know, I was a hippie, so I liked the Grateful Dead, and they were doing space jams or whatever that was called. And that was real abstract stuff, which I wasn't quite getting. But, you know, once I sort of heard more free jazz, it began to connect. And I actually have a very funny Ornette Coleman record that Jerry Garcia plays on. Sometime in the 80s, there's Jerry Garcia doing little, you know, his little guitar thing up against Ornette's sax, which was really great. So those connections are like always there, but they're not spoken of. And once, you know, once you hit Thelonious Monk, then you go, well, then anything's possible, right? And, you know, kind of, you know, if you have a curious mind, you put the dots together. Also, you know, I came up in the period of punk after I was a hippie. I was a punk. And unfortunately, well, first I was a kid into like metal and, you know, like Led Zeppelin and all that kind of stuff. And then I became a hippie and I sold all my Led Zeppelin records. And then when I became a punk, I sold all my Grateful Dead records. And then when I became an avant-gardist, I didn't sell my punk records, but I had to go back and I had to buy both the Black Sabbath records and the Grateful Dead records again, which I really love. And that's why I always loved the genre of mashups.
Oh yeah, okay.
So you're taking a Grateful Dead and you're taking a Ornette Coleman and you're putting them together and you're syncing them up and they make sense. And then you can throw in a Britney Spears or something on top of that. I was like, this all makes sense to me. You know, it all makes sense to me. That was kind of the beginning of that stuff.
So the things that you would have been broadcasting at that time would have been unbelievably wide and diverse. And it's hard to think of another program that would have been doing that at the time.
Well, I mean, listen, I remember one time I did my last show I did there was called Kenny G's Hour of Pain. And I would take an hour, only 1 hour, and play the worst thing or the most painful thing I could do. I remember one time I took an hour and I played Chicago live at Carnegie Hall from like 1974. I played like just like the worst Chicago record. It was a huge box set, white, creamy cover. And I knew it would just drive people, you know, all the underground music fans on FMU, would drive them crazy by playing Chicago for an hour on FMU. That was really a way to get to them. I mean, I'd given them all sorts of noise, all sorts of impossible things. And I thought, now I'm going to get you with Chicago. Right. I'm going to really get you because I can throw anything at you and you're going to say, this is great. Or this is what Kenny G does. Yeah. Now I'm going to hit you with Chicago. And that's when the complaints really started coming.
Yeah. So, I mean, but these things interact in a strange way with the sort of composition per se with written music, because there are all these different parallel trajectories now in the world of composition. And it's getting to the point where you can't really say what the line is between sound art and composition and improvisation and electronic music. And does it matter anymore? You know, do we need to care?
I don't think so. I mean, once you have a laptop, everybody becomes everything. Not only do you become an improviser and a composer and a sound artist, but you also become a graphic designer and you begin to, you know, you become a video maker. I mean, all of the, you know, once everybody has a laptop, all of those distinctions, I hope, really break down. I don't think enough is made of that, though, or spoken about it. I mean, you have places like The Wire that continue to kind of, you know, separate genres. They tend to be a little purist over at The Wire, though I appreciate what they do and what they have done for many years. But I also think that's a little bit old school. In a time in which, you know, people are gallery artists, they're poets, they're sound poets, they're composers all at the same time. I mean, why would you be one thing anymore when there's no verticals anymore? It's all horizon. And that's why, you know, on Uberweb, I can have somebody as diverse as Howard Finster and Pierre Boulez, and they make sense together, I remember at one point, because Uberweb is organized alphabetically, I have Captain Beefheart up against Samuel Beckett, right? B-E-F and B-C-K, you know, about that. And I thought, well, this is amazing because you've never heard the word Samuel Beckett and the word Captain Beefheart together. It doesn't happen. In Beckett studies, they never talk about Beefheart. And in Beefheart studies, they never talk about Beckett. But of course, how could they not be together? I mean, obviously, you know, there's so much to talk about there. You being a Beefheart scholar, I'm sure you could read Beckett into it a million times over. And I thought, like, those are the impure connections that I want to make on Uberweb. And they simply just happened by happenstance. That just happened alphabetically. And I was like, Beefheart and Beckett, sure.
Yeah, it's so exciting to hear you say that also, because, you know, this is partly what I'm trying to do with this channel, with the podcast, is that some of the guests that I've had on are really, you know, at complete opposite ends of whatever spectrum this is. So I'll have Brian Ferneyhough on one week, and then the next it's you know, the drummer from Captain Beefheart. And I think those sorts of connections are incredibly fascinating.
And they're not spoken about. I mean, was Ferneyhough a Beefheart fan? Did you ask him?
You know what? I didn't ask him.
See, you have to ask these kind of more classical composers. You have to go into guilty pleasures with that. You have to ask them what are they embarrassed? What are they listening to that they're really embarrassed to say? And then you find out that everything's impure. This is what happened with Napster, was that, you know, everybody thought that everybody on Napster had was sort of pure, but you browse another user's files and they were, again, alphabetically, like the Captain Beefheart and the Samuel Beckett thing. And you'd see that I was going for somebody's John Cage folder. And then when I browse their files, there was a C-A-G-E next to a Mariah Carey thing, C-A-R-E-Y. And of course, you know, I mean, people like Mariah Carey as well as John Cage. I mean, that's real. That's the real way. Nobody just listens to John Cage. I do think a lot of people just listen to Mariah Carey. But I would bet most avant-garde fans, you know, listen. You know, I think the classic thing, the way into all that would be through Brian Wilson. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, there's every avant-garde fan loves the Beach Boys. That was a natural thing, and it was always a little guilty, but of course, you know, everybody would, you know, there was a great argument to be made for that. And if you kind of dig a little bit deeper, you'll find weird things like, you know, Mariah Carey. And certain, you know, so that was, to me, like I said, well, this again is the strain of impurity. It's like, we're not really that pure. There's like all sorts of other things that are happening in there. And let's admit it. I mean, it's not a, you know, again, the avant-garde would say, well, I only like avant-garde things. And then secretly, they'd go off and listen, you know, to Big Spiderbeck or something like that. Sure. You know, but they wouldn't talk about it. You know, maybe it was too low or it was too popular, something like that. But I think I think now we can admit those things. So you need to ask people like Ferneyhough about what pop music they really loved.
Yeah, right. What are the things they're embarrassed to admit? Yeah.
That's right. You have to ask all those composers, you know, and also then the Beefheart people, you know, because they'll tell you that they're Scarlatti fans.
Well, this is the thing. I interviewed Art Tripp, you know, who is a member of the Mothers of Invention and Beefheart band, percussionist, yeah. And I had no idea about this, but he told me that when he was a percussion student, he was playing under Stravinsky's baton, and he was he knew all this stuff. He'd played to the American premiere of Zuclus of Stockhausen. Nobody knows this.
Well, I think, you know, I'm a friend of John Zorn, right? And Zorn, that's what Zorn was always about, all those early pastiche pieces of using his record collection as ways to make the game pieces. You know, here's, and he Zorn loved to talk about Coggle. You know, he loves Coggle, or in the old days was referencing Coggle more. But the eclecticism of Zorn's output is really unbelievable. Now, John puts out 50 CDs a year of his own stuff. And it's good. And it's strange, you know, and it's very, you know, he'll do a 12-tone thing, and then he'll do a lounge jazz thing, and then he'll do a hard, you know, a metal thing. You know, all of these are incredible, and they're all really, really good. And John, you know, on the stuff that he puts out, he doesn't, you know, he releases it himself. He doesn't send out promotional copies. He would always send, they'd always send them to FMU. You know, I don't know how you're going to quantify a career like Zorn's. And I would say you should have John on, but John would never do this because John doesn't often like to talk about what he does. So there's this like rat's nest of composers, like somebody like Zorn that's put out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of records of the most diverse styles. And I'm thinking, how in the world is anybody going to make sense of this? And he just keeps putting more and more out. And it's good. He can write a 12-tone piece like nobody's business. And then he can write an electroacoustic piece like nobody's business. I mean, he's really good at these things, and he's got the best players. So that's, John is a really interesting figure, I think, for this impure strain.
Well, I think what's interesting also about that is he's a figure that's really outside of the institutionalized world of new music. And, you know, like you talk about, why don't more people do this? Why don't we have more composers who are also poets and so on? And part of it is possibly marketing. Part of it is possibly also the fact that a lot of them are really ensconced in institutions, and they have to be able to explain what they're doing in terms of research. They have to be able to frame it that way. And that also constrains things. I think that constrains what they're willing to deal in their work.
Well, that's
work.
Why John funds all his own work. You know, he doesn't get grants. He's vehemently unaffiliated with institutions. He's been burned by record labels. He's been burned by critical stuff that, you know, people writing shit about him that he was completely untrue. He said, fuck it, I'm packing it up. I'm going to do my own production, and I'm going to become an island unto myself, and I'm going to release CDs by my friends, stuff that I like. I can do insane stuff. You know, John gives me box sets of his Bagatelles, which are just the most beautiful pieces. He's now putting out like, there are four CDs in each gorgeous box set. He's got his own designer. He uses the most incredible materials. And he can put out his Bagatelles, which are immense, and issue them himself. I mean, you know, but it could be, also becomes a problem of quantity. Because in a time when everything is available, now this is another angle, in a time when everything is available, like, then what do you do? What do you do with all of that stuff? And this goes back to folk archiving, because we have, all of us have more music than we can ever listen to sitting on our own hard drives. And so the organization, the collection of them, the archiving of these artifacts becomes more interesting than the actual traditional engagement and use of them. So in a way, it's structural. We've become, all of us have become folk archivists, managing our, you know, I have more PDFs and EPUBs because I can get them. And because I'm worried they're going to disappear from the cloud, let's say, where I'm getting them. So I hoard. I become a cultural hoarder. And in that hoarding, there's an organizing, a preservation, a redundancy, a backup. And this is sort of all I've done on UberWeb, is to try to save this. I work with an organization called the Memory of the World, right? And these are pirates. These are called pirate care. People that use piracy as a way of showing that they care about cultural artifacts by preserving them, preserving the memory of the world, okay? So to me, like, archive.org is such a miraculous mess. But, you know, what UberWeb does is it contextualizes things. It makes sense of the mess. If it's on UberWeb, I've picked out all that stuff, by the way, and I don't know anything about what I'm doing. I'm a fucking poet with a BFA in sculpture. I'm a folk art historian. I took one class of art history in college, and that was on Baroque art. Okay, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. You know, so it's, but I've been doing it for so long that it's all like, it's a Wunderkammer. It's not a library. It's not an archive. It's a fucking Wunderkammer. And that's all it is of my own, my own weird whims. And there's nothing. But because it's been around for so long and people have taught it and learned from it, they think it's canonical. It's not. Or maybe it's become, but accidentally. I didn't start. It's just a shit like those concrete poems that I put up.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of a problem with Ubuweb. If it was done correctly by art historians, it would be a very different site. But then it wouldn't be eccentric. It wouldn't be quirky. It wouldn't be an artist or a poet's taste. So in a way, it's dirtier and it's more, it's warmer in that way. But it also makes sense. So I'll go on to archive.org and I'll go looking for things. I found beautiful radio shows on archive.org of Alice B. Toklas talking on KPFA, right? And I'm like, nobody knows this exists. I'm going to pull that thing down onto those radio shows of Alice speaking onto Ubuweb. And of course, there they are, And I don't just link to them because that link is going to die at some point. You have to download it and you have to, put it on my own servers. Now, this gets us into another situation that Ubuweb really isn't about the accumulation of avant-garde artifacts. That's really easy to make an archive the way I've done. I mean, I've done it for 25 years, so it's big and I'm curious. Okay, that's fine. But the real point of Ubuweb is to keep this going, number one, with no money, and number two, to keep it going because it's completely illegal. There's no permission. I've never asked any permission. I've never paid any money. I mean, there's nothing. I do it and nothing ever happens. So this, to me, is an example that copyright, as it's put out there, actually doesn't exist. And that's a big thing that people need to learn. That in fact, I remember in the days of the MP3 blogs, right, 2009, and then the RIA went after people and all those blogs started shuttering entire ecosystems. I mean, basically those MP3 blogs in 2000s were Ubuwebs. They were people that were ripping vinyl. The more obscure they could do, they would put it up and they put it on rapid share. But they got wiped out with one cease and desist letter, which was so unnecessary. Beautiful ecosystems, beautiful collections were down. That's why I say don't trust the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
The cloud's a really bad idea, man. They can shut you down. They will shut you down. You have to become independent. And Ubuweb is at this point just about completely independent. It's going to be really hard to shut Ubuweb down.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, like the idea of keeping it going is more important, the juggling act of that, than the actual work on the site. The work on the site, that's easy to make a collection of avant-garde things, even though it's not that easy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you make of things like Spotify and YouTube and these sort of portals to infinity that we have now, where you can sort of go on to Spotify and get, not everything, because obviously there are all kinds of things that aren't on Spotify, but there's a lot of things on Spotify.
There is.
But it may not be permanent.
Well, I know Spotify or Apple Music feels pretty permanent to me. And I think it's a marvelous thing. I mean, you pay $15 a month and you get every piece of music ever recorded. Mm. But the question then also becomes like, well, so what do I listen to? And that's why radio still remains important. You need somebody to show you what's interesting. You need somebody to walk you through, say, this makes sense with this. What you're doing on this. You're explaining things to people. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of information out there. I mean, there was a time in which, as a record collector, I could collect, every Chess record, let's say, every Chess record. And they were all out of print, but you'd kind of go around. And then in the 80s, I remember all the Chess records were reissued as like $3.99 kind of discount discs. And I bought all of those. And at a certain point, on my shelf, I have all the Chess records, all the Chuck Berry records, all of that stuff. At this point, and with the CD, you didn't just get a record, but then you got all of the extra sessions, right? So it starts to be like the Chuck Berry records, they're like 12 minutes a side. I mean, they're really beautiful and you'd only listen to one side, right? But when the Chuck Berry sessions, the Chess sessions came out on Chuck Berry Is on Top or something, you'd get, you know, you'd get another 2 hours worth of stuff. Mm. This becomes the beginning of the problem of abundance. And what do you do with that? And, you know, so suddenly we're going from like a beautiful 12-minute listening session to an hour and 12 minutes or 2 hours and 12 minutes. And you'd feel obliged to keep that CD on in a way that you never felt obliged to listen to both sides of a record. When you had an LP, you only listened to the A side. Rarely did you go to the B side. It had to be really good. Or you went to the B side and never went to the A side, but usually the other way, right? So we have, already was this problem with the advent of the CD of too much to listen to, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, you mentioned the Beach Boys earlier, and that's a kind of an extreme example in this sense, because, you know, if you bought a Beach Boys LP in 1964, you'd have 24 minutes of music or something. And then they started getting into remastering them with bonus tracks and then with the sessions. And then it got more and more extreme. Then there was this bootleg label called Sea of Tunes that somehow got copies of every single session tape and issued all of them on CD. So it's like suddenly you have like 15 takes of Little Honda, one after the other on a single CD.
Yeah.
It's like, what do we do with this?
Well, it assumes that everybody's a completist. Mm. Everybody's a scholar of this stuff, you know? And I don't know, what do you do? Okay, so the latest thing of that was the Peter Jackson remix of the Beatles' Let It Be, right? Did you see that?
No.
Okay, so do you know about this?
I know about it, but I haven't
okay,
seen
right?
it.
Okay, so, right? So basically, the movie Let It Be was, you know, an hour and 20 minutes, a sad movie, beautiful movie. But then Peter Jackson gets 600 hours of footage or whatever and makes 8 hours out of this and tells a different story. It's a really interesting idea. And it just makes me want to go back and watch Let It Be, the original film. This was boring. And I'm happy to be a Beatles fan. You know, I love this stuff. But even for me, it was too much. I didn't want to see 8 hours of it, you know? So that's the thing. I mean, there's this thing that you feel an obligation, particularly when you pay for something. When you bought a CD, the Pet Sounds box set, you know, you spent $50 on that thing. You think I should listen to all of this stuff. Now the Pet Sounds box set is up on Spotify or Apple Music, and you just, you know, you turn it on and you can turn it off, and you know, it's like a spigot. Mm-hmm. So I think this is the problem of abundance is really, really a major issue now. And then it leads to problems of evaluation, you know, because when everything's available in such abundance and so many people are doing things, then what makes one thing better than another? So I have these books at home on my shelf called the Rolling Stone Record Guides. And there were these books that were put out in the 70s. And I think the last one they did was probably about 1990. But they would be different editions of the books. The first one is sort of 75, and then there are successive editions. They keep changing. But what this book proposed was that you could tell the entire history of rock music in one volume. You could evaluate every record that was put out with stars in the history of rock music. And it was sort of possible at a certain time because there wasn't that much stuff out there. And an artist's discography had just, you know, whatever official releases were. Sure, there were bootlegs, but they didn't really deal with that stuff. They dealt with the major labels and the stuff, and it told a great story. And it's really fun to go back and see what, you know, some Jimi Hendrix record, you know, how it was received and what stars, and then how that changed over the course of time over these books. But I realized that stops in about 1990, with the advent of DIY press stuff, where there's just an explosion of music out there, which you can't possibly. Today, if you were trying to write a Rolling Stone record guide, forget it. With all the stuff that's out there, all the stuff that's been released, all the CDs, all of the digital stuff, all the SoundCloud stuff, how the fuck are you gonna do this? Mm-hmm. How are you gonna evaluate it? So like, then this, nobody can, you know, there'll never be another Pierre Boulez. There'll never be another Andy Warhol. There'll never be another Bob Dylan. There'll never be another Led Zeppelin. That was the end of that era of giants, Picasso. Everybody's diminished now because the landscape is horizontal with lots and lots of tiny little anthills as far as the eye can see. And around those anthills is a little group of fans and a little circle of fans, but it's too vast You know, so there used to be huge verticals in culture, and that's why we don't have that. And that's why you're a great composer, you know, but you're never going to be a John Cage, not because you're not as talented as John Cage, but because there never will be another John Cage. And I think, you know, this is this, even politicians and movie stars and even athletes are diminished in this way. Everybody's diminished. All culture is diminished in that way. And that's not such a bad thing, I think. But if you're a person that's trying to make sense of the cultural landscape, it's a mess. How do you decide one thing is better than another, really? Also, in a place where bad taste is now good taste, you know, who's to say what the fuck taste is anymore anyway?
You know, there's two sides to this, because on the one hand, of course, that's absolutely true. But what it's also meant in a practical sense is because of the abundance and because of the significant amount of support that exists now that didn't exist in the post-war years or the Weimar years, for that matter. You know, if I compare the career trajectory that I've had to what someone like Varese or Webern would have experienced, you know, Varese maybe had 20 or 30 performances of his music in his lifetime. And, you know, I might get that number every year. But I'm not going to have anything near the level of influence of a Varese at the same time.
Absolutely. I think it's a really, really good point. The pool was so much smaller of artists working because, you know, because of the explosion of the culture industry, there's a lot more people out there working. So if the pool is that much bigger, your influence in that pool is going to be that much smaller.
So there's one more thing I want to ask you about, but before I get to that question, I just want to point out to everybody who's listening that I really admire your radical openness and your willingness to make connections that are not obvious to other people. And I want to give a quick example of that. So I met Kenny about 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. It was at the book launch for Eunoia by our mutual friend Christian Book, Canadian poet, brilliant Canadian poet. And one of the things that really struck me when I first met you was how extraordinarily open you were. You had no idea who I was, of course. I wasn't anybody at that time, for that matter. But we had a really wonderful, engaging discussion about music that I could not have had with many other people at that time. And at the end of it, this was probably 2 or 3 in the morning, you said something like, "Oh, give me your address and I'll send you some books when I get home." And I thought, okay, sure. Like, is he gonna do that? It's easy to say. And 2 or 3 weeks later, I got a package of books in the mail, including Soliloquy. You sent me a copy of Fidget, 73 Poems. And those books were really important for me. And I want to point out that it's really, it's very hard to know what the impact is going to be of meeting somebody. But the reverberations from that can last a very long time, a very, very long time. And that support, that feeling of, you know, it's worth it for me to send my books to this person who I don't really know yet. That was tremendously encouraging, and I want to thank you for that.
Well, you know, I think that's so beautiful to hear, and you never know. That's why I really think that change happens person to person. Like, I don't know about, I'm not interested in political change on a large scale, because the things I'm interested in are really quirky, and you just, the right person is going to be hit by that, where politics deals on a mass level. That's for somebody else to do. My politics are like the politics of Uberweb and changing lives through exposing to an artwork that can fucking change a life. You know, my life was changed by certain artworks. And I remember, you never know. I remember one night during the pandemic reading a book by an art critic called Maurice Berger. And he'd written a book or catalog essay on the artist Adrian Piper, who I was teaching at the time. And I was really loving Maurice's book. Little did I know, at that moment, Maurice was dying of COVID. And that night that I was reading that book, he would be dead of COVID. And Maurice had no way of knowing how his essay that he had written 20 years ago was affecting me at the moment of his death, right? And he would never know, but you never know. That's why it's important for artists to do what they do, because you never know who's receiving it. There's no way of communicating that. So it's kind of spiritual. You're putting something out into the world. And this is just why artists, I think, need to keep producing. Because, you know, John Cage said something like, I had no support, but because I believed in what I was doing, I knew that one day it would be received, even at a time when I had no support. He knew that what he was doing was going to be important. That turned out to be true. Similarly, and I, you know, I talk about Duchamp and I talk about Cage and I talk about, you know, Burroughs. These are sort of people that I'm really touchstones, Warhol. Duchamp, in 1913, when he was asked who his work is for, he said, it's not for now, it's for a generation 50 years hence. So in 1963, he has a retrospective at the Pasadena Museum of Art, his first kind of showing in a million years. And at that time, conceptual art is coming up and minimalist music is coming up. And Dennis Hopper shows up at his opening and Marcel Duchamp is a celebrity, exactly like he predicted that 50 years later, there would be the audience waiting for him. In the last 5 years of Duchamp's life, he was a superstar. Because he absolutely knew that. And he was silent, you know, the silence of Duchamp, of Marcel Duchamp. He spent 40 years not making anything. Well, of course, we know that he was secretly making things. But there was just that beautiful faith in throwing something out into the world that, in fact, if you thought it was important, it would be received and it would change lives. And you see it again and again with people that are doing really experimental work that have no reception. To me, I say, keep going, because if you're doing something that really is important and you feel in your heart that it's important, it's going to change lives down the way. And to me, that is the best definition of art that I can offer up.
That's a good place to end it. Thank you, Kenny.
Thanks, Sam.